Tonight on Arena, reviews all the way with overcompensating Murderbot and Garbo on the TV and new albums from Will, Ezra Furman and Tuneyards. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Start with our TV reviews this evening. Murderbot is Apple TV's highly anticipated sci-fi comedy based on Martha Wells' novels and short stories. Alexander Skarsgård plays Murderbot, a rogue security android who has found a way to disable his governor module. This means that he can now stop following orders and do what he wants himself, effectively. He uses his free time to watch soap operas and occasionally and reluctantly guards the humans on his watch. Comedy is also to the fore in overcompensating his new to Prime Video shows and follows. This show follows Benny, played by Benito Skinner, former high school football star and valedictorian who struggles to accept his sexuality. Now he's starting college, finds it difficult to fit in. Things look up when he befriends Carmen, played by Wally Wareham, an attractive outsider. The series follows their escapades, hookups, fake IDs and flavoured vodka shots. And finally tonight, new documentary, Garbo, Where Did You Go? First documentary in a new Sky Arts season called Sisters of Disruption, dedicated to celebrating trailblazing women artists who have reshaped the worlds of music, literature, art and film. In Garbo, we delve into the life of the famously reclusive Hollywood legend, Greta Garbo. Of course, it tells the story using a blend of rare archival material, intimate letters and stylized reenactments. Chris Wasser and Dee Malumbi are with me in studio this evening, and let us start with Apple's foray into sci-fi comedy and Murderbot. Sci-fi comedy, is it a well-known genre, or am I living under a stone? Are there that many funny sci-fi series?
Oh yeah, sci-fi. Well, now that I think about it, a show that springs to mind when I was watching Murderbot because of the show within the show format, because this cyborg is addicted to space soap operas, was Galaxy Quest. So I'd consider that a sci-fi comedy. That's a bit of a classic. But that show is not always in the vein, or Murderbot's not always in the vein of Galaxy Quest. But there is something quite likable about this, and it basically, Alexander Skarsgård is playing this security cyborg unit, and its job is to protect humans on, let's say, some intergalactic mining facility or construction site. When we first meet the Murderbot, it actually hasn't given itself the name Murderbot. Yeah. It spent its latest assignment, it should have been looking after the humans, but it considers humans a waste of space, basically, and it spent most of its time trying to override and self-hack its governor module, which is to say that if it can break its ties with its, you know, corporate overlords, basically, it can have free will.
It can
do what it wants. The only problem is that once it has free will, doesn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Because, again, its only interest is watching space soap operas. So despite the fact that it can go anywhere in the world, anywhere in the universe that it wants, despite the fact that it gives itself this dangerous, cool name, Murderbot, it decides to stay and do the thing that it's always been doing, which is to protect humans.
Okay. But Murderbot finds itself, and they're very careful about the use of pronoun, actually, in the programme itself, particularly the humans, this kind of group of hippie scientists that end up buying him. That's the heart of the story, really, Dee, and how that group of people interact.
Yeah, and they basically buy him because he's cheap, because he's not like the very latest model. So they're kind of this hippie commune that I suppose are investigating this terrain inhabited by like giant centipede aliens. Very Starship Troopers, actually. And I suppose watching this show, I was a little bit reminded of Paul Verhoeven's RoboCop as well, obviously,
as a reference, but it's certainly not as serious as RoboCop.
Yeah, exactly. So characters here include, all these members of this commune. There's kind of this lesbian couple, one of whom is considering having an affair with a man. You have a tech nerd named Garathan, who's played by David Dastalmation.
Who's an augmented human. So he's kind of human with a little bit of computer added.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out, is he meant to be kind of a bishop type, you know, kind of from the Alien franchise or something? I never completely figured it out, to be honest. But the whole idea is that he's a tech nerd, but he's the one that's primarily suspicious of Murderbot, aka Sec Unit, as they kind of call him.
And
he's
security like, unit, Sec
yeah,
unit
yeah,
for
and
security
we should be
units.
Kind of like suspicious of this guy. And then we also have Mensa, who is basically the team leader.
Yeah.
She's also a mother of seven, so she has those kind of maternal feelings, I suppose.
And she really is a wonderful character in this, played by, what is her name?
Noma Dumezweni.
Yeah, she was in, I think it was The Handmaid's Tale. I remember her somehow from that. I can't remember the specifics of the character, but very recognisable face. Anyway, let us listen to a clip from Murderbot. And here's the bit you were talking about earlier on, Dee, where they're sitting in front of the corporates who are saying, you have to have a security unit with you and we want you to buy the latest model. Will you see this? But in the background, and you'll hear him in voiceover, is Alexander Skarsgård's slightly kind of worn down secondhand Fiesta feel off him. And he's going, oh, they're going to choose me.
This is the newest model available. A perfect blend of power and performance.
Oh, actually, there it is. In the flesh. Well, I mean, in the armor.
Where's the one behind that? Look at that piece of crap. Oh, that's me.
Yes. What is behind it?
That's a refurbished model. It's being phased out. Shouldn't really be in there.
Which one's the least expensive?
Well, that one. But you get what you pay for.
I'm not sure we should go for the cheapest one.
I agree. Don't rent me.
I think we'll take the modestly priced one.
You sure you don't want
good
to see?
Good. Then it's settled.
Not yet. If you'll give us a moment, I want consensus.
And get in him. Yeah, there we go.
What the hell was that?
It's a deal.
Oh.
There you go. So that's by the way, they were kind of communing in a circle and all humming together so that they would have consensus. That's what they were doing there. And the decision is made that they will buy the cheap model, the old-fashioned murder bot or bot played by Alexander Skarsgård. You get a sense there. Skarsgård has a difficult task here because he has to play this essentially robot with no emotions. But he kind of finds himself being attracted by the humans in some ways.
Yeah.
And he does have emotions.
It's a difficult task because Murderbot, you know, is inherently repulsed by human emotions, but is quite drawn to these oddballs who have no handle on their emotions whatsoever. Like, you couldn't have picked, you know, a messier group of people to befriend. But the fact that it has free will now, it's like it's willing to kind of ask more questions. And that's what kind of, you know, David Demalchian's character, that's why he's suspicious in the first place. Because
David Demalchian, he's the augmented human.
Yeah,
of course, the augmented human doesn't want the robot who's going to have a bit of human in him. They're two sides of a different coin.
Yeah, yeah, and it knows how this robot should behave. So the fact that it's asking questions and the fact that it lowers its helmet, I mean, you couldn't have a series called Murderbot starring Alexander Skarsgård where you never actually see Skarsgård. So they've cleverly decided, okay, let's move the lid here. I think it's a nice performance from Alexander Skarsgård. I was thinking of other performers who might have fit the bill, a couple of the famous Ryans, Gosling, Reynolds, but then Reynolds has already done the Deadpool thing. And there are some shades, just some, don't let that put you off, of Deadpool here, maybe Nicholas Hoult. But Skarsgård is very good at playing emotionally vacant characters who you're always quite suspicious of, but at the same time, charmed by. And that's the thing about Murderbot. It's totally weird, you don't trust it, but you also... every time Murderbot disappears and we're just focusing on the scientist, you want it to come back.
Yeah, because there's a section, I only got to see the first episode, and the section of that episode when he disappears for a while, and they start getting into this terribly serious conversation about whether they can trust him or not. You say, don't care about that. Just let's get him back on till we see what he has to say. And despite the fact that he's in voiceover a lot of the time, he pulls it off, Skarsgård.
Yeah, to be honest, I wasn't mad about Alexander Skarsgård's performance in this. Okay, so I thought he made some kind of strange acting choices, and to be honest, like, I was never fully on board with him. It's interesting that Chris describes him as inherently repulsed by humans, because I was kind of inherently repulsed by his performance. Like, I got what he was trying to do. Like, this is the vibe I was getting. He was basically trying to be Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator 2. Let's be honest here. He's trying to do that whole android, like, crossed with humanity.
But he's slightly black humor underneath it, yeah?
Yeah, I didn't find the series that funny overall either. So, like, for me personally, it didn't work. There were aspects of it that I really liked. I thought the world building of the actual sci-fi elements were really good.
Like the effects and all of the rest of it.
Exactly, yeah. I did find that this was a world that I could get lost in, and I did find it quite interesting stylistically. But there was something about it that it was just never quite clicking for me personally.
Right. So I suppose as you give us stars then, do you think this is for a wider audience or is it for sci-fi?
I think it's kind of for probably a more niche audience. Like, I do like sci-fi comedy. Like, a series like Rick and Morty comes to mind, which I'm a massive fan of. But there was something about this show. Its kind of pacing was stalling a bit for me as well, which is interesting because it's a 30-minute long episode. So you think that it wouldn't be. But yeah, maybe it's one that's more so for niche audiences. I personally was left underwhelmed and a bit uninterested in what's going to happen next. So 2.5 for me.
2.5. I think you're in a different boat on this one, Chris.
A little bit higher. I think the human characters are thinly drawn, so as a result, kind of difficult to like because we don't know much about them. The show within the show format is quite fun, but it also shows
you... Yeah, because he's watching this bot who falls in love with the commander.
Yeah,
with some
great guest stars, Clark Gregg and John Cho, but that just kind of serves to remind you of how much more fun Mortarbot itself should be. But I like Skarsgård in it. I like the world building, as Dee said, so I'm going to go with a solid 3.
Solid 3. 2.5 and 3, respectively. And it is on Apple Plus. I think there's 2 episodes available.
2 now, and then weekly.
Okay, let's move on then to Overcompensating. Benito Skinner plays Benny here. He created the series, he's acting in the series, and he's an executive producer on the series. The character Benny, his name is Benito. Is he telling his own story here, or am I jumping to conclusions?
I suppose we could assume that, but I mean, as you're watching it, it's very much an exaggerated view of university life. But at that, it was an exaggerated portrayal that I would definitely want to get lost in myself. But yeah, the whole idea of Benny is, I suppose, that he had everything going for him in a high school. He was a star football player. He was prom king. He was valedictorian. But essentially, when he starts off in university, he's kind of starting from the very, very bottom.
Yeah.
Now, his sister Grace is already in that university.
And they don't get on that well.
They don't get on
that
well.
Not at the beginning, but I feel they might get on better as the series progresses.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you do have that like kind of classic sibling rivalry and the fact that their parents, who are played here by Kyle MacLachlan and Connie Britton.
Brilliant, the pair of them.
It's brilliant casting and so, so funny. I wish we'd actually seen them more in the series, but they're very fun whenever they are in it. But yeah, they show very obvious favouritism towards Benny. So that's definitely a big reason for their rivalry there. But yeah, nobody knows that Benny is actually in the closet. He is gay. And while he's at university, he befriends a girl called Carmen. And that's kind of where all the action kicks off.
Yeah, and that Carmen character equally has secrets in her background and secrets in her past that she's not fitting in college either, Chris.
Yeah, she is a little bit like Benny in that she has, you know, familial secrets, you know, a tragedy involving her brother. She doesn't really know who her friends are, has no real friends.
And
at
bad
university.
Relationship with her parents.
Bad relationship with her parents, is leaving behind, you know, a bad relationship with a toxic guy that she went to school with. So she's looking to make a connection. And at first she thinks that she might have a romantic connection with Benny because Benny's friends, you know, they put this idea in his head that everyone needs to hook up on the first day of college or else you're a loser. So they both feel pressured to come together and to do that on their first day. But what they realize is that they have something that's deeper. And although she doesn't, you know, she has her suspicions at first, she doesn't know anything about her sexuality, they decide that their friendship is more important. Let's put some time into that. And they become the best of friends and they help each other out through what is actually a very difficult year for them.
And here's the moment quite early on in the series, actually, where they're sitting around in a circle, you know, freshers day, and there's these freshers, 2 second years up, standing, persuading them to come and join freshers, whatever particular society it is that they're running. But you get a sense of the lovely kind of easy relationship that begins to build between Benito Skinner as Benny and Wally Barham as Carmen.
Who do you want to be?
I don't know.
It's a dumb question.
Okay, but is it a dumb question, or are we just dumb for not having an answer?
Both? Where are you from?
New York.
Like Manhattan?
No, like right outside the city.
Brooklyn.
Right outside that.
Queens?
I'm from Jersey.
Sick.
No one has ever said sick when they hear Jersey. Where are you from?
Idaho.
People are from there?
Yes.
Do you have any, like, movie theaters there?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
There are 2.
And how many of your cousins have you hooked up with?
Also 2. I'm Benny.
Carmen.
There we go. Benny and Carmen beginning to get to know each other in that scene from Overcompensating. We were saying as we were listening to that, Dee, it is great fun. Yeah, you have those two characters, but you've got, I don't know if it's, is it unfair to say you've a bundle of stereotypical, you know, not high school movies, but college movie type characters behind them.
Oh, yeah. And you have kind of those like very typical scenarios, like you've got kind of your dorm rooms and your music concerts and stuff like that. But yeah, I really enjoyed the depiction of university life here, all the opportunities it presents, the absurdities, the eclectic mix of quirky individuals. And I mean, these young people are deeply, deeply flawed. They're weird. They're disgusting. They're stupid. Yeah. They're horny. They make some very, very questionable choices. And yet there's something very, very likable about all these characters. They're very well cast. Very good performances here. It's a bit like, I suppose American Pie was what was coming to mind, but something a bit more sharper and satirical. Yeah,
isn't one of the creators of American Pie, is it Paul Weiss? Was he involved in American Pie?
That was Murderbot, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry, Murderbot, yeah. Different series.
Interesting link, yeah.
He should have been involved.
He should have been involved in
this as well. But at any rate, Dee mentioned the parents. I must say, I wanted to see more of them. Did they come in and out as the series progresses?
They
is it concentrated on the college...
No, they're very much just like they're just sprinkles on the cake here. Like and you could say that they're underused, but it's probably perfect because this is all
about
Benito.
It's about the college life.
Yeah, but I'm never not going to see Colin McLaughlin and say, oh yeah, we just about got enough of him. You always do want more. But there is this nice idea there that, you know, Benny in school, he has to study business and his dad has set up a business job for him and he's going to do exactly what his brother does and his dad is expecting that of him. But you kind of get the feeling that if he just talked to the parents, they'd be okay with him doing his own thing.
Of course they would, because they're good parents.
Yeah.
And the other thing that we should mention is there is a fella that right through the first episode,
Miles,
the character of Miles, that Benito is like oogling at every time he sees him walking past.
Yeah, Miles,
that relationship is going to grow, I'm guessing.
It is, yeah. He sees Miles in the hallway played by Rishat in the first episode and he thinks that guy is the one. And he's also in a film studies class, which I think gives the series probably its best joke in that, you know, the film studies class is full of film bros and I won't tell you what they all say their favourite film is. It's a very funny moment in a series that's full of them. But I think the reason this series works so well for me is that if you brush away all of the crude punchlines, if you brush away all of the noise and all of the stereotypical depictions, it's got a big heart and there's a sweetness there that makes you want to keep coming back to it.
I must say, because I just thought those two characters, the Benito Skinner character, Benny, and Carmen, the Wally Byron character, I want to see how are they going to develop as individuals, where are they going to get to as college goes on. Stars from you on this one, Chris?
Yeah, I'm going to stick with it. I should say as well, there's a lot of semi-autobiographical stuff in there too, and that, you know, Benito Skinner is showing us this is what college was like for me, and that he actually didn't come out until his senior year. So he's kind of, you know, telling some of his own story here, and quite effectively, I think. Sometimes it gets a little bit lost in terms of what year is this actually set in, but we won't worry about that. I was going to say 3.5, but you know what? I'm going to go with 4. Lovely performances from the two of them.
All right, 4 from you. What are you saying, Dee?
I feel like I might also go bump it up to 4 from 3.5, because it was a very enjoyable series. And they're very much leaving it on a cliffhanger at the end, but I have high hopes for where the story is going to go next. It's so entertaining. The characters are delightful. There's like an authenticity to it, but also mixed with a very good sense of humour. So it's really enjoyable. And all 8 episodes are on Prime Video now. We'll get more.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, that sounds that both of you have had a good time with those two, Murderbot and Overcompensating. Dee and Chris are going to stay with us and we'll be talking about a documentary with Greta Garbo after this. All right, Dee Malumbi and Chris Wasser are still with me in studio. They've already been speaking about Overcompensating and Murderbot, on the subject of which, by the way, caller or texter 743, I can only identify them by the last 3 digits of their phone number, liked Alexander Skarsgård in Mute in 2018, says texter 743, was an interesting project that he took on. Murderbot seems similar. So there's one for us to go check out as well. Mute from 2018. And I hope that caller will get a chance to look at Murderbot and have an opinion on that as well. Let's move on to our final subject this evening, our final programme this evening. Sky brings us Garbo, Where Did You Go? First documentary in their Sisters of Disruption season. I mean, Greta Garbo is such an enigmatic figure for lots and lots of reasons, Chris. How does this documentary go about telling her story.
Yeah, I think Lorna Tucker is out to ask the big question for us, which is, you know, everyone thinks of Greta Garbo and they just think of that sometimes when they're not thinking of the films, they think of the famous quote, "I want to be alone." And this idea that, you know, she retired at 35 and then just disappeared. But she didn't just disappear. And there were reasons behind her retirement. And, you know, she actually didn't want to just stop making films. She had been quite hurt by the box office failure and the critical failure of Two-Faced Woman in the early 1940s. And she had accepted other film roles after that, but they just sort of fell through. So it's an examination of that and all around the retirement, but also, you know, the actual person and what was it that inspired her to go into acting in the first place. And Tucker is telling that story through archive footage, through the use of 200 unpublished letters, which have been provided by her Greta Garbo's great-grandnephew. And also, they're using this theatrical aspect where they have a performer named Ellen Daniels playing a character known as the Investigator, who is basically investigating Garbo's past. And if that wasn't enough, they have a performer in a sort of a paper mache mask. Whenever you hear letters being read by Noomi Rapace, and also whenever you hear recorded phone calls, you see a performer in a Greta Garbo mask. So there's an awful lot going on in there,
yeah,
Sean.
There is a lot going on. But certainly in the section of it that I got to watch, I learned a lot about Greta Garbo that I didn't know, particularly her very happy childhood up until a certain point, the death of a parent being obviously a huge loss for her, and her absolute love and obsession with the theatre. And that she knew from very early on, that's where I want to go.
Yeah, and actually the documentary kind of delves into how being part of this theatre group was really kind of the happiest time in her life. And yeah, there were a lot of interesting aspects to her childhood and kind of this working class background. For example, when she was very young, she actually landed a job at a department store, which at the time would have provided, you know, quite a bit of security, not only for her, but for her family. But she did decide to leave that that job because she got her first role in a movie at the age of 15. And with the support of her mother, she decided to kind of pursue the acting full time.
Because a job in a department store for somebody of her class and social standing at the time would have been considered, this is great, you're made for life now. Yeah. But she gave it all up. And the director, the Swedish director Moritz Stiller, is important, very important in her story, both in Sweden and later in America, Chris.
Yeah, you had this Finnish filmmaker, silent filmmaker Moritz Stiller, who discovers Greta Gustafsson and decides,
as she was known, and decides
that, you know, I'm going to make you a star. And he takes her under his wing, brings her to America and gives her her name. You know, he thinks like, okay, you need a catchier name to star in these films. What maybe he didn't expect, and they're all sorts of question marks, I think, about their relationship. It was perhaps a problematic one, and 22 year age gap, and we don't quite know the ins and outs of their relationship, but we do know for certain that Garbo's star ascended. You know, it's the star is born story, and Stiller's didn't, and he ended up going back to Sweden, dying quite tragically, apparently with a picture of Greta Garbo in his hand. And her career took off, because she was one of the few silent film stars who was able to transition successfully into talkies, because Garbo's voice was so powerful. Yeah. I mean, her films when she went into the talkies were marketed as Garbo Talks. Other stars weren't so fortunate. And I think the European factor as well played a huge part.
Yeah. All right. As you both said, letters and archival material play a huge part in this. So we're going to listen to a clip. And the first voice that we'll hear here, in fact, is the director, Lena Einhorn, and she's talking here about, it was Louis B. Mayer who persuaded Moritz Stiller to go to America, and he would only go on one condition, as we'll hear in the clip. And then we'll hear Garbo's thoughts, and it's Noomi Rapace, as you say, who is voicing these, Chris.
Louis B. Mayer shows up. Stiller was a famous director, and he wants to get him to Hollywood. He was also a very narcissistic type of guy. You know, he wanted to make it big, 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 big. And here comes Louis B. Mayer, serves everything on the platter. And he said, well, on one condition, that I can bring my muse with me. And reluctantly, Mayer allowed that. So Stiller and Garbo go together to Hollywood.
It was strange, a very strange feeling. I was looking forward to something that I've never seen. I did not know how it would turn out. My mother didn't say very much. She reassured me that I would be happiest pursuing my dreams, wherever it took me. Alua was so upset that I was going without her. But I told her that I'd be back in a year.
Noomi Rapace there as the Garbo's thoughts in that clip from Garbo, the title of the documentary on Sky Arts. Dee, you get a sense of the family relationship is so important to her, and she really misses everything about them when she's in America. How well does this look at what made her talent so attractive to so many, and then why she effectively cut off and said, no, I'm out of here?
Yeah. Yeah, well, Chris kind of touched on it there in that, like, she was one of the actresses that made, like, the transition from silent to sound movies effectively. But I think another thing that she did, which the documentary kind of delves into quite effectively, is that she was able to bring this emotional depth to characters that weren't necessarily written like that, that she wasn't necessarily directed to bring that kind of emotional depth, but she just got it. There was something
and
that clicked from her.
And she refused to do, like, she stood up to the studio and said, no, I'm not prepared to play a woman like that, particularly in a film called The Temptress. She said, no, I'll work out how this is done. You're not going to tell me what I'm going to do.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, some of her other films were like quite revolutionary. Like for many people, she remains like the great portrayal of Anna Karenina. Queen Christina is still a hugely important text when you're looking at kind of early queer cinema. So she was, huge and everything. But yeah, like you said, the documentary also does go into that kind of early retirement. And you do really feel for her when you see the mobs of fans and photographers who are just like fascinated by her love life and just scrutinizing her all the time. They talk in the documentary about how she was followed by cars, how fans would stand in her backyard. And you have to remember, like, this was at a time where celebrity hadn't really existed to this kind of point before. So she just wasn't expecting it at all. She just wanted to act. She didn't want the fame that came with it.
And so we get Greta Garbo syndrome, which is this idea of, reclusiveness and closing yourself off and I just want to be alone, all of that. How well is that portrayed?
As well as it can be, because we know a bit about that section of her life. And I say that section of her life from 35, the next 30 or 40 years, but not a whole lot, because she stopped going out. But that doesn't mean that she stopped having fun. And the film does remind you that, she had a lot of friends and she kept a very busy social life and she had lovers. And, there is this happy portrait painted there of Greta Garbo after retirement, but it reminds us that retirement was never really part of the plan. Again, she was saying yes to film, she did consider scripts, but either those projects fell through or she pulled out at the last minute because she didn't think maybe they were good enough. And she became probably increasingly paranoid a little bit too, because there's a recording with her friend and art curator by the name of Sam Green, who she was quite close to, but then learned that he may have leaked a story about their friendship or something that she just told him. And we hear her scolding Sam over the phone, saying, I only told you this.
However, it does take them quite a while to get this. It's kind of in the final third. Towards the end of the documentary.
Yeah.
And briefly, I have to say, I found the pacing, particularly in the early scenes, get on with it. Tell the story, will you? Stop taking big, long pauses.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's called Garbo, Where Did You Go? But they only get into the Where Did You Go part in the last like 20 minutes or so.
Yeah. Stars then from you on this one, Dee, first of all.
Yeah, I would give it 3 stars. I do feel like I probably appreciated it more than I necessarily enjoyed it. The style of the documentary, like, I could appreciate the fact that it was doing something a bit different, but it was a bit strange and off-putting. Those papier-mâché mask sequences were a bit kind of odd. But I do think that people who are familiar with Garbo's work will very much enjoy it.
Stars then, what did you say?
3 stars.
3. What are you saying overall, Chris?
I'm probably going to go the same, because I could listen to stories about Garbo all day, but I went into this expecting a film, and at times it gave me a little bit of a theatre art installation vibe. Doesn't need that. The Greta Garbo story is interesting enough without those additional flourishes. But again, it's a fascinating watch. 3 stars.
3 stars from Chris on that as well. Garbo can be viewed on Sky Arts and Now TV. It's all part of their Sisters of Disruption series, while Murderbot is on Apple TV Plus and Overcompensating is streaming on Prime Video. Dee Malumbi and Chris Wasser are reviewers on this Friday evening. And so to our album reviews, John Maher and Nadine O'Regan are with me in studio. Oakland's based duo, Tuneyards, deliver Better Dreaming. This is their sixth album. Marks a return for the duo of Meryl Garbus and husband Nate Brenner. Emerged from a desire to create music that encourages movement and joy, especially after the stillness imposed by the COVID-19 pandemic. That's what they're saying about it. Ezra Foreman returns with Goodbye Small Head, personal album written during a period of illness, drawing on themes of loss, of control, identity and survival. Furman's latest work is a blend of alt-rock and certainly some wonderful orchestral moments in there as well. And Irish post-punk trio Mwail release Something Soft. And despite that title, don't be misled, the record is confrontational and spare, tackling feminism, consumerism and the loss of a band member. With me in studio, as I say, John Maher and Nadine O'Regan. We're going to start with Tuneyards, and this is how the album opens. Heartbreak, the title of that opening record, or opening song rather, on Tuneyards and the new album, which is called Better Dreaming. Six albums, I think, more than a decade of experimentation. I'm wondering, does this, John Maher, do we see a different side to Tuneyards in this album?
I think so. I mean, when Tuneyards first emerged, they were often kind of bracketed under the freak folk movement from about 15 odd years ago. And I think this is a significant progression. You know, there's a lot happening with the orchestra, with the arrangements.
Yeah.
And vocally, Meryl Garbus sounds very soulful here, I think, in ways that she perhaps didn't before. Not just on this song, but throughout the album. I mean, there are moments on this that reminded me of Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
In terms of phrasing, in terms of just her the way she delivers kind of quite dense, complicated lyrics. So as somebody who had listened to Tuneyards early on and sort of thought not necessarily for me and then kind of abandoned them, coming to this anew, I was pleasantly surprised.
I remember Tuneyards was in the programme very early on in her career. Maybe the first album, maybe the second album. And she did a gig in Whelan's that night. And
it's probably around 2009.
It was something around about that time. And the gig in Whelan's, like, that place was hopping. And live performance, because of all these loop pedals and all the rest, it's really impressive. But how do you get that onto a record?
It's funny, it's so much more interesting to watch her perform at times than just simply to hear the record. Because when you see how she organises the song live, you know, she sings a bit, like that particular song that we've heard, I've seen her perform it online, and she'll sing the first phrase and the machine will capture the lyric, and then she will push it into the chorus while she sings another lyric against it. And she's also doing percussion at the same time. She's drumming, she's doing little percussive touches. I mean, it's really quite marvellous to watch her perform, and there's no doubt that she's one of those musicians that, you know, you have to hand it to her. She's virtuoso in what she's doing, but is what she's doing, you know, what a sizable majority of people want to listen to? I mean, they are six albums in and they remain, I suppose it's fair to say, deeply experimental to their core. Now, they have described this album as being more upbeat, more bouncy, more kind of...
And their kid is on it.
Their child,
I'm never
Leo,
sure you
3 years
ever
old.
Have your child on your album.
Yeah, he features on the song Limelight. And to be honest, I was saying to John outside, I sort of struggle with the idea that an experimental duo suddenly decides to go pop or go a little bit more commercial, because there's a sort of assumption there and kind of a pretension and a notion that for them to go pop is for them to, I don't know, slum it a little bit.
Yeah.
And actually to make pristine, beautiful pop that is heard around the globe by billions is a really difficult task.
If it was easy, we'd all be doing it.
You know, there's a reason why, you know, Toxic by Britney Spears is the song it is.
Yeah.
And if everyone could do it, you know. So like, I struggle with that a little bit as a concept. And I also sort of struggle with, I mean, that track Limelight is a bouncy, happy track. And Garbus has said that she said this one almost didn't make it onto the album because it felt trite, especially given multiple genocides across the globe and the impact on children. And, you know, I just sort of wonder a little bit about sort of saying publicly that you can't produce a happy song in the context of unhappy times. For me, that again, you know, maybe it gets to the nub of where I struggle a little bit with the band, because I think they maybe have a pretension that is less pleasing.
Nadine mentioning there, are pointing out to us just how much what's her name?
Meryl Garbus.
Meryl Garbus does on stage, and how much of the sound is down to her. What's Hubby doing? Is he producing it? What does he give into it?
A significant role to play in terms of the music, the sonic backdrop. I take Nadine's point to a degree, but I think sometimes artists are their own worst enemy. Sometimes they can, you know, it's best to just listen to something in isolation, rather, because I also read some of the stuff that she was commenting around her own album, and it was putting me off listening to it. And sometimes when you just hear the music, it stands for itself. She's definitely kind of wrestling with the idea that there's a lot of bad stuff happening in the world.
Yeah.
But also, they're parents of a very small child, and they're a happy family, and they want to embrace that. And so there's certainly some deep themes being explored here. But the music on the whole is playful and jaunty, I think. And I found it quite engaging.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a track called Never Look Back. There we go. Never Look Back from Junior. Just briefly, lyrically, what are they singing about here as you give us your summary again, John and Stars? Or Nadine, do you lyrically, what are
we
talking about?
Well, I mean, actually, I did sort of a very boring academic thing. I went through the lyrics online to read them down straight, because they are singing about things. When Meryl's singing about things like male abuse of power and support for trans rights and other, you know, she's very socially engaged and she has a very strong political conscience, and it's worth saying that. But actually, when you're listening to the record, it's oblique. So you do need to really work a little bit to hear it. Yeah. So it is quite oblique. Yeah.
Overall judgment on Stars.
I mean, people will. There are certain, you know, category of people who will love this. For me, it's a 3.
But you had a great phrase about how you feel about this
music.
Easier
to admire than love.
Easier to admire than love. I like that. 3 stars. And John.
I understand what Nadine is saying. I have to say I admired it, and I think there's a lot that's very, very good here. I have to be objective and give it 4 stars. If I was being subjective, I'd probably give it 3.
All right, okay. If you're being subjective or objective, you'd give it 3.
Objective, 4.
You'd give
as,
it.
Yeah. As an album in terms of how it's made. But the one thing actually I didn't say is, you know, it feels quite claustrophobic. It's a bit of a closed loop. And I think that's a bit of an issue. I'd love to have had more players, more life breathe into it from different perspectives.
All right. Let's move on then to album number 2, Ezra Furman. Goodbye, Small Head. Just before we play the first track, this is an album made after a difficult period in Ezra Furman's life. Nadine?
Yeah, I mean, Ezra Furman revealed publicly in 2021 that she was transgender, and she also made it public that she'd been a mother for 2 years at that point. And she, you know, she identifies as, well, I mean, actually, I interviewed her about 10 years ago at a point that she identified as male. But in the past number of years, she has, as I mentioned, identified as female. And now she described in 2021 how when their baby was born, that she had approximately 0 examples that she had seen of trans women raising children. There were some really difficult experiences that she had in terms of problems with landlords, moving around. And you know what? This album is very important as a document of an underrepresented group. And Ezra Furman has always been provocative, but particularly for those reasons, it's interesting.
Well, hardly surprising then, given what you've been speaking about there, that the first track in the album should be called Grand Mal. It's Grand Mal, opening track on Ezra Furman's new album, Goodbye Small Head. And you were saying, John, as we were listening to that, that it's helpful to define to Grand Mal and what she's singing about. They're amazing vocals, it has to be said.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the album is inspired by ill health, and this Grand Mal is what's known medically as a tonic-clonic seizure, which can cause loss of consciousness, violent muscle contractions. So quite a serious thing. Mm. And Ezra Furman has been through the ringer.
Yeah.
And I suppose in a way the listener goes through that ringer as well. I mean, that these are challenging songs.
Challenging lyrically,
but not necessarily musically. Yeah. Like there's a great eclecticism to the sound. But when you really parse the lyrics, there's a lot happening here.
And you mean the wonderful orchestral arrangement underneath that song that we just listened to, Nadine, and there are string quartets further on. These arrangements are very impressive as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's an album that is, like, for me, it's a funny one because Ezra Furman in general, and I was talking to John about this earlier, the vocals are very strong. But at the same time, they're probably best taken in small doses, as indeed the entire album is. If you listen to sort of three songs, that's a lot.
You can't binge this one, no.
And actually, she kind of comes across vocally, for me at least, as sort of an off-kilter blend of Lou Reed, Brian Molko of Placebo, or even actually Marilyn Manson a little bit at points. Right. And the same is true, the same kind of movement is true of the genres. You know, like she has a punk rock background, was very informed by bands like Bush growing up, but then there's like country aspects that sneak in at times, so you're bouncing between different genres.
So small portions,
small
on
portions,
this one.
Yeah,
stars on it, Nadine.
Well, as a document, as a social history, I do think it's a 3.5, but as an album as a whole, for me, it's a 3.
And what are you saying, John?
It's a 4 for me. I agree with Nadine that sometimes in short doses it works, but I think, again, artistically, there's an awful lot happening here and I need to give it more time, but I think it's a special album.
All right, OK. Let us move on then to our third album from Irish post-punk band Will. We'll start with the opening track on the album, Pursuit.
Crisscross the path ahead. If I run really fast, will I make it to my bed?
Yeah, lovely drawl that she has, particularly in those spoken sections. That's the voice of Constance Keane there in the opening track, Pursuit, from Will, and an album called Something Soft. And yeah, that is a misleading title. It gets really industrial and punky towards the end of that, John.
Yeah, her voice is completely ragged. It's thrilling at the end of this. And they play an Irish tour, hometown tour, in a few weeks, and I think some of these songs are going to sound fantastic. They've been through personnel changes.
Yeah,
I mean, Róisín Ní Gheald was the previous front woman. She was asked to leave the band after the release of the first album. There was kind of a difference of
artistic differences
and so forth. And Zoe Greenway has also left, so it's reduced now to a 3-piece. But in some respects, that's a good thing because there's a focus here.
And what is that focus? I mean, the punk and the industrial sound are very much to the fore. Yeah, there are soft moments, but it's out there in terms of noise.
No, they're a band with a mission statement. I mean, they want to point out, I guess, the patriarchal structure that underpins so much of society. There's a lot of anger there. And, you know, one thing that actually is a little bit frustrating on this record is some of the lyrics are so good and you really want to hear them, and they're placed quite low in the mix. And what that means is that you're having to fight a little bit. And the lines are very good. Like, there's that line, DMAM, which is about the DMs that somebody might send you. And then if you call them out on it in the morning, they'll say things like, "What if I said I didn't mean it? Please don't screenshot it and send it to my mom. I already told you I'm sorry. I was only having a laugh." All the things that guys sometimes say to girls when they have done something the night before via text message that is inappropriate or wrong. And they're very, very good, the band are, at pointing out those kind of societal ills that sometimes we gloss over. And I find this very impressive. You know, they're, as a band, I could see them supporting. I mean, Nine Inch Nails are coming to Dublin soon. You could totally see them supporting Nine Inch Nails. And there's a lot of bands coming out now that are informed by that sort of industrial, also 90s sound.
And as well as that industrial, noisy 90s feel, there's also a bit of fun on it, particularly in
the phone song's great.
But it's also, the Call Me Back is a kind of a barb in it too.
Yeah.
Could you say what you said before? Is it really played? Now I'm such a sure.
to get a sense of the fun that they have. I love how that 1-800 or whatever buttons they're pressing become the actual melody. But we were saying, as we listened to that, picking up on Nadine's point, John, the vocals very far back in the mix, and it's a bit frustrating at times.
They are, and just as I was playing, I was mentioning the yeah yeah yeahs. I mean, Karen O, how strong her vocals are and how it could work so well here.
Stars overall, John?
I think there are some outstanding songs, but it fades a little bit in the middle for me, so 3.5, but I think there's so much potential in this band.
Nadine?
Yeah, I liked it to start and it's only growing on me, so I'll go 3.5.
Wales, Something South, Hours of Form and Goodbye Small Head, and the Tune Yards album, which name I cannot remember, but it was the one we were talking about first. Very quickly, what have you been listening to from your old back catalogue that you've been loving, Nadine?
Yeah, I actually been going back to Massive Attack's Blue Lines, and I think it was because I just spent a lot of time walking lately, and for some reason the Sharon Nelson video, Unfinished Sympathy, kept coming back to me recently when I was walking through Dublin.
You
familiar with that video where she's walking through LA?
Oh,
and it's
brilliant.
A continuous steady cam shot, which also was the same sort of shot employed in Adolescence. So,
there you go. John?
Loy Cole and the Commotions, Rattlesnakes, debut album 1984. I came back to it again recently after years away. It's such a masterpiece.
Yeah, well, it's always good to visit old friends.
For sure.
To visit old albums. That is, there's no doubt about that. John Maher and Nadine O'Regan are two reviewers on this Friday evening, and that is our lot for this Friday, indeed for this week. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Kieran Dunn was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sian O'Gorman. I'll be back with you on Monday, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.